Good morning. Make sure this is okay. Good. Whew. This is still working. I don't have to stand behind the podium the whole time. Oh, I get this. Got this newfangled technology. We're gonna try this out. See how this works. Good morning to you. Well, I want to share something with you today. I want to talk a little bit about something that's it's been kind of interesting. You know how God works in your heart, and you know, like you kind of come up with an idea, and then you start seeing things fall into place, and that's kind of what's happened, I think, this morning, and I hope that that is for you as well, as we look at some scriptures and we look at some ideas of what I'm calling the rhythm of life. I'm a drummer, okay? I'm a percussionist, so I'm the guy that's always kind of tapping over there. So rhythm kind of speaks to me, a rhythm, kind of rhythm of life. But rhythm of life is something that I don't know that we consider all often enough as we move through this crazy world that we call American modern society. So we're going to talk a little bit about that this morning. If you will, pray with me as we get started. Father and God, we come before you this morning to worship you, to honor you, to praise and lift up your name. Father, you are holy, holy. You are the one who sets captives free. You're the one that brings order out of chaos. You are the one that redeems your people time and time again. And so, Father, this morning we sit in your presence. We ask you to be among us. We ask your spirit to move with us. Let the words that are spoken today be your words, Father. And let the deeds of our hands this week be your deeds, that we may always represent you as ambassadors to the world, that they may see Christ in us. It's in your Son's name we pray. Amen. I don't know about you, but I am a Super Bowl nut, right? I love the Super Bowl. Now, I am not a big football fan, okay? I do have some football fans in my life. They're right here. This is from a few years back. This popped up on my Facebook feed. You know how it comes to that old history? And I was like, who is that little boy? I'm like, I don't even recognize that kid anymore. But that is not... That's my wife. So Super Bowl time rolls around. She is on the sofa with a jersey on, rooting for not the Cowboys, obviously, but whoever's on the TV on Super Bowl. And I am in the kitchen cooking, right? I love to cook. But I do love the Super Bowl because I love the commercials, right? I watch for the commercials. Now, it maybe have something to do with the fact that I've worked in newspaper and radio. I've done advertising for many, many years. I've done marketing and stuff like that for years. And so I'm always interested to see what companies are going to do. What do they think is going to work this year? How they're going to capture our attention. You know, the cost of a Super Bowl commercial nowadays, did you see the news? You probably saw the news on this. $5.6 million for 30 seconds. 30 seconds. $5.6 million. Now, they have 30 seconds. These companies have 30 seconds to do something phenomenal, right? They have got to get your attention. And if you're in the radio business, they'll tell you, you've got 5 seconds to do that, right? I've already missed my window of opportunity this morning, right? If you're already sleeping, I've already missed the boat, right? I had to get your attention right off the bat. 5 seconds, you got to get their attention, and then they've got to craft a story, they've got to craft something that's going to grab you and get you and make you decide to change your behavior. Do something different than you were planning to do 30 seconds earlier. Completely different. Now, sometimes that's pulling you along. I knew a guy one time. He was a master marketer. He worked for the New York Knicks in the basketball team. The Knicks were horrible at the time. And so he was trying to sell tickets to the Knicks game. And so what he did was he promoted all the other teams that were coming to play the Knicks, right? So he's like, hey, you want to see the Lakers? Come see the Knicks because the Lakers are going to be here, right? You know, that's the way he was a master at this. But the problem is when you were at your office or your home or whatever and a letter showed up and it said the Knicks on the outside of it, you're like, I'm not... You throw that away, right? I'm not watching. So he sent packages to people that were tubes, right? Round tubes. And you're like, what in the world is this tube? And so it said Knicks on it, but it's a tube. I mean, who's not going to open a tube, right? You get a tube at your office, you're going to open that thing up. So he opened up the tube, he pulls out a rubber chicken. The guy said, the only reason I had a tube was because I wanted you to open it, right? So then he says, the only reason I had the rubber chicken is because I wanted you to spend some time reading what was at the foot of the rubber chicken, right? Rubber chicken serves no purpose at all. There's not a mascot of the Knicks or anything. All it was there was to get your attention to say, I want to read the next thing. So he pulls it. So then the next thing is a little card that says, you could watch the Lakers and whoever else. I'm not a basketball fan either. Whoever else is there for this price, right? For more information, call this number. And so people started calling the number. He sold more tickets. He made millions of dollars within 2 weeks of that ad campaign just because he was getting their attention. That's what they do. They get your attention, try to get our attention, then try to change our behavior. So I think about all the commercials. This year, I'm going to tell you, the commercials this year were duds. There was not a lot of great commercials this year. But if you think about over the years of Super Bowl, because Super Bowl is such a big thing, all the commercials that were seen at Super Bowl and how much of an impact those did have, not all of them did what they intended to do. I mean, they have some of these that nobody changes their behavior because they saw it. How many of the times you watch a commercial and you're like, I don't even know what this commercial was for, right? Or sometimes we love the commercial. Oh, that was a great commercial. We still can't tell you what it was for, right? We still don't even know. But anyway, this was, think about over the years, some of the ones over the years. The Big Mac, right? So it was a Super Bowl commercial that introduced this song right here. To all beef patties, lettuce, cheese, there you go. Did it work? I don't know. When's the last time you had a Big Mac? Yeah. Okay. We think it worked because we said all the right things, right? We know the language. Are we living it out? Are we living it out? Do we actually go eat Big Macs? Harry, you want a Big Mac today? Yeah, Harry's like, give me a Big Mac any day of the week. I think it's because it's bigger than him, like it's bigger than his head. He's like, a sandwich that's bigger than my head, that is amazing. So anyway, that was a huge commercial. 1975, by the way. 1975, not to make you feel old or anything. Where's the beef? Where's the beef? Everybody knows the song. Now, when's the last time you had a Wendy's single? Oh, okay. Okay, we had one. We don't have Wendy's here in town, so it's a little harder to get. But yeah, where's the beef? Huge commercial. It was a hugely popular commercial giant. Okay, what about this one? This was an Apple commercial. Now, I didn't want to show it because at first, well, I just did the video. But when it starts out with George Orwell's 1984, you know, and you have all the slave-looking kind of people, all the same color, and then you have this woman running down with a giant hammer. She throws the hammer up into the screen. The screen smashes, and then this rolls on the screen on January 24th. Now, this is Super Bowl, so we're in the middle of January. Super Bowl was a little earlier back then. Middle of January, about a week or so ahead of time, Apple will introduce a new Macintosh. You'll see why 1984 will not be like 1984. Right? Macintosh was a huge success. How many of you own an Apple product? This was the start of Apple right here. This commercial ran one time. It never ran again. Once at the Super Bowl. You think that was a pretty good investment for Apple? It's not bad. They did what they got your attention. And they changed people's behavior. Now, this is kind of the rubber chicken idea, right? They're not really trying to buy and sell you a Macintosh with this commercial. They're just trying to get you to show up to watch the television event of the Macintosh being announced or introduced. It's a tease to get you to the next stage before they can sell you the Macintosh. What's this commercial? What? So what song was this one? I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect, okay, harmony. So this is an interesting story. The guy who came up with this, if you watch Mad Men, I love the show Mad Men too. It's not anything like Mad Men. The guy who actually came up with this, his first name was Bill. He was stranded in an airport in the middle of Ireland. The fog had rolled in, some storms had rolled in, all the airplanes had been canceled for the evening, and so he was stranded there. They had to put them all in hotels or stay in a place. This is Ireland, and so it was like bed and breakfast or whatever. Anyway, so everybody was angry, they were upset, everyone was just, I mean, it was just horrible. The next morning, he got up and he strolled down into the area where the airport was,
And there were people sitting laughing. The same people who the night before were all angry and upset and, you know, we're in this horrible foggy situation. And they're all happy and kind of laughing. And you notice they're all sitting around the bar, but they're not drinking Guinness or any kind of beer or anything. They're drinking Coca-Cola. And this thing went off in his head and he said, wow, I'd like, and he pulled out a napkin and he wrote down, I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company. I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love, with turtle doves and however the song goes or whatever. And so he took that day. That day the flights picked up again. They flew. He flew on into England. He sat down. He shared the lyrics. They already had the song. They were waiting for lyrics. They didn't have lyrics for it. And they put the song together. It came out on February the 12th, 1971. This is just a few days before my wife's birthday. And actually, my daughter's birthday is February the 12th now. And so song came out and it bombed. Like it did nothing. Like nobody liked it. And the guy was really upset because he thought this was a real winner. So he convinced Coke to kick in some money and make a TV commercial out of it. Right. And so they spent $250,000 on a television commercial, which today is about $1.6 million. It's the most expensive commercial ever made. They were going to put all the people on the coasts of Dover, the white cliffs of Dover, all these kids singing the song. It started raining. It kept raining. They couldn't do it. Eventually, they moved to Italy where the weather was nice and they filmed this thing and it became this. And it turned out to be number 7 on the Billboard charts of 100 in terms of songs. A Coke commercial. Just huge. And Coke saw a giant jump in sales for the next 8 to 10 years. They tracked that, the effect of that commercial. Did what it was meant to do. Somehow it caught our attention. It convinced us we wanted to do something different. So, let me see what I've got next here. Yeah, so here was the very end of it. This is the end of that commercial. Assembled people from all over the world bringing this message. Coca-Cola bottlers all over the world. It's the real thing, Coke. What is it about these commercials that make us change our behavior? What is it about these commercials that grab us and want us to do something? Well, there's a lot of different things that are going into this. A lot of psychology, and they'll tell you the science of it. But really it comes down to something is creating fear. Creating fear. Now, you may not have seen a Coca-Cola commercial and all of a sudden felt this emotion of fear, right? You know, it's not scary. But what it's creating in you is the fear that something is not right, right? Like something could be better. They're going to paint a world where things could be a little bit better if you just bought our product. If you just had what we were selling, things would be just a little bit better. In social media, this is termed FOMO, fear of missing out, right? The fear of not having something, right? Now, I am guilty of this, let me tell you. I am a gadget freak. Right? I could spend hours on Kickstarter or Indiegogo or some of these websites that people are inventing new stuff. And I'm like, ooh, I've got to have that. I got to have that. Right? Now, I got it honestly. My dad was probably the same way. My kids are unfortunately probably a lot like me. But I'm like, I've got to have this. What am I going to give up for it? Right? What am I going to do? The fear of missing out. Something is missing in my life. If I just had this thing, if I just did that thing, it would be so much better. And I've lived my life. I tell you, I'm going to tell a story of my wife. Can I tell the punishment story? I'm going to put her on the spot. I'm going to tell you a story anyway. It's okay. I've told a story lots of times. You probably have heard this story. My wife, the fear of missing out. Okay, so in her family, watching the Waltons was the big deal, right? Watching the Waltons was a big, big deal. Thursday night. Okay, see, we didn't watch the Waltons in my house. So every Thursday night, they watched the Waltons, right? Well, Lena had done something that day and had gotten in trouble, right? She was in some serious trouble. And so she had a choice. Her dad, who's also here in the audience today, said, okay, he's a fair guy. I'm going to give you a choice. You can skip watching the Waltons, or you can take the punishment of a paddling and watch the Waltons. Right? It's your choice. Take the paddling. He's like, I don't remember this. I've had this confirmed. So take the paddling, watch the Waltons. Don't watch the Waltons. It's your choice. Whatever you'd like to do. So she goes upstairs to her room, and she sits in her room. The family settles down to start watching the Waltons. And the fear of missing out starts to build and gets worse and gets worse and gets worse. And 45 minutes into the show, she has finally reached her limit. Can't take it anymore. I am missing. The family's laughing downstairs. Ha ha! Having a good time. You know, little Johnny, John Boy. She can't take it anymore. So at the commercial break, at 45 minutes after, in the middle of the show, she comes down the stairs and she says, okay, I want to watch the Waltons. So her dad, okay, bend over. So, whap! She takes her licks. She sits down and she watches the last 7 minutes of the Waltons. Which makes absolutely no sense because she hasn't seen the previous 43, right? She has no idea what's going on in the Waltons. I said, only you could work yourself into getting the punishment and missing it. You had a choice and you wound up you missed on both, right? The fear of missing out. You know what I'm talking about? This idea of, I don't know what. As we get older, I discover the fear of missing out turns into something even worse. Now it's called the fear of missing out for my children. The fear of my children missing something. And so at the slightest drop of the hat, the slightest instance or inkling of an idea, I might like to do that. Hey, soccer looks fun. Bam, we're doing soccer, right? Ooh, gymnastics. Yes, we're going to do gymnastics. We're going to spend all the money. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're driving them from Boy Scouts. We're driving them for band. We're doing this and that and this and that because they might find what they're good at. And I don't want them to miss out on what they're good at. Because if they miss out on what they're good at, then they might not get a real good college scholarship. And if they don't get a good college scholarship, they're not going to get a good college education. And if they don't get a good college education, they're not going to get a real good job. And if they don't get a good job, they might miss out on the ideal spouse that they're supposed to have. If they don't have the right spouse, they might not have the perfect family. That's a big burden to bear. Do you know what I'm talking about? Have you seen your kids or grandkids toting people around all day long? It's what we do because we're afraid of missing out. Now, there's another side to this. And it happens as we continue to get older. And maybe somewhere, this is where you've been, that at some point, there's so much that we're fearing that we miss out that we start to shut down completely. And we get so overwhelmed that instead of trying to accomplish everything, we rather turn and kind of recede back behind everything and kind of start letting stuff just go by and say, if I can just maintain right here, and we kind of close in on ourselves and we don't become involved in anything because it's just so overwhelming. Have you been there before? Yeah. You know, the good news is this. We, you, me, we're not the first people to deal with this. This has happened since the beginning of time. And God says, I am here for you. Don't be afraid. I've come to eliminate fear. Don't worry about missing out on this life. Don't be of the world. Be in the world, but be of me. Live the way I want you to live. And I'll take care of the rest. My daughter turned 18 this week. 18 years old. Right? She sung every 17-year-old girl song she could think of on Tuesday afternoon, right? Before she turned 18. She's only 17.
dancing queen on 17, you know, whatever. She's all this kind of stuff. And then she goes, I don't want to be 18. I said, why not?
I just don't want to be
the responsibility, right? Because I said, like, well, now you got to pay for your own car, you got to pay for your own insurance, you got to go find a place to live. I mean, you got all these responsibilities going to start on Thursday, so you better get cracking on this deal, right? No, she wants to be a kid where someone else takes care of that, right? I can remember my son Harry's not quite there now. He for many, many years, he'd get in the car every single morning. And he's like, what are we doing today? It's like, well, today's a school day. All right. Yeah, right. What are we doing today? Say Saturday. What? Are you serious? Yes. You know, it was so exciting for him because he started the day. What's happening today? And this is what God really wants for us. Right? This is not just a dream or a fantasy of being a kid again and letting someone else be in charge. It's what God says, look, I am here for you. Just give it to me. I want to look real quickly at a few passages to kind of think about some folks who'd struggled with the same fear throughout the ages. And then look at what God did for us all in order to give us a kind of a path out of that. And then maybe share something at the very end about how we can approach that going forward. So the first thing I want to look at is over in Genesis. I told you, it's from the beginning of time. The very beginning of time, we've seen this situation. Genesis chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. This is a story of Adam and Eve in the garden. Imagine, you have everything you want. God has created this paradise, right? And He placed Adam and He placed Eve together. You're married. There's no one else to compare to. This is the best ever. You walk with God in the afternoon. He comes and you're there together in His presence. And yet in the midst of having it all, right? What are you missing out on? You have it all. It's everything. And in the midst of that, we see the serpent who comes and plants a seed of doubt in the mind of this couple. Now the serpent was shrewder than any of the wild animals that the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, is it really true that God said you must not eat from any tree of the orchard? The woman said to the serpent, we may not eat from the fruit of the trees of the orchard, but concerning the fruit of the tree that's in the middle of the orchard, God said, you must not eat from it. You must not touch it or else you will die. Now, I don't read this as a rule about what you can and can't touch. I read this as about a warning about what you don't want to touch. Right? I've told this story before. My kids, my high school kids tell me I'm horrible. But Peyton, when he was a little bitty kid, he had a love affair for the stovetop, right? Man, that thing glows orange. That is the coolest looking thing in the world. I was like, do not touch that. Do not touch that. Man, he would get over there. It's warm. Oh, that is awesome. A little bitty kid. And so one day, we had finished cooking. I turned it off, and it was still pretty warm. It wasn't hot, but it was pretty warm. And he's like, Dad, oh. I was like, Peyton, do not touch. And he looked at me, and he did this. And I walked over to him, and I said, and he went, ah! That's when my kids go, you're a child abuser. Well, no, it was fine. No blisters. There's nothing like that. But he learned a lesson pretty quick, right? I'm telling you not to touch it, not because it's like some rule that I've just created that this arbitrarily you're not going to do, but rather, you don't want to do this. Surely it will hurt. Don't eat of this tree. Surely you're going to die. The serpent said to the woman, surely you will not die. For God knows that when you eat from the tree, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And thus sin enters into the world. Let me tell you something. Sin, you can boil every sin down in the world to one simple thing, and it's called idolatry. It's trusting, believing,
following something else instead of God, replacing God with something else that we worship, that we consider worthy of following. Sometimes it's even myself, self-idolization. A lot of times it's something else. Here the woman says, when she saw the tree whose fruit was good for food and was attractive to the eye and was desirable for making one wise. Where does wisdom come from? Where does wisdom come from? God. God is the source of all, the ultimate source of all wisdom. And yet here the woman says, oh, eating this may produce wisdom for me. She took some of it, fruit of the fruit, and ate. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and they ate as well. The fear of missing out on something different. But I could be wise. I could be God. And here comes sin crashing into the world with horrible results. Let's move over a little bit farther. Someone else. 2 Samuel chapter 12. We get the story of David. Now you know David, this little shepherd boy. He's raised up to be king over all of Israel. He has everything he wants. Riches galore, palace, wives, he's got everything. And yet one night, on the rooftop, looking across the way, he sees something he does not possess. Something he feels might be even better than what he's got. And the fear of missing out on the one thing he doesn't have drives him to sin. And not only sinning by committing adultery, having an affair with this woman, but then he compounds it by trying to cover it up all the way to murder, murdering the woman's husband. And then we get the story in 2 Samuel chapter 12 where Nathan the prophet comes in and Nathan has told him the story of the rich man taking the poor man's little lamb. And David gets all upset. He goes, that's horrible. I can't imagine a rich man has all this stuff. And he takes what the one thing that the poor man loved the most. And Nathan looks at David and he says, you are that man. This is what the Lord God of Israel has said. I chose you to be king over Israel. I rescued you from the hand of Saul. I gave you the master's house. I put your master's wives into your arms. I also gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And all of that, somehow, if that seemed insignificant, I would have given you so much more as well. Why have you shown contempt for the Lord's decrees and in my sight? This is why I can identify with David. I have everything, and yet my eye still wanders. And I think, what's going on? And I hear Nathan say, you're that man. The next one is Luke, the prodigal son. We've heard the story of the prodigal son. We know the story pretty well. Boy comes up, father's still alive. He says, Father, give me my inheritance. I'm going to go and take it. I want to do my own thing, right? I'm going to go do my own thing. So the father gives him his inheritance, splits his wealth, gives the inheritance, presumably giving the inheritance to the older son and to him, so that's even divided evenly, and the son goes off and squanders it. And at the end of it, the son realizes, you know, what he was missing out on at the big cities and all the parties and all the things was not half as good as what was back home. In fact, he says, it would be better to be eating the squalor of the pigs of my father than it would be to be living in this situation now. So he goes back, and the father welcomes him with open arms. And a lot of times that's the story that we take about how we wanted to do something and now we realize, but there's a deeper warning in here, especially for those of us who've known God and tend to still want something more, who've walked with God like Adam and Eve, who've been called righteous in God's eyes like David, and yet still desire something more. The older son became angry and refused to go into the banquet. His father came out and appealed to him, and he said, but he answered his father, look, these many years I have worked like a slave for you. I have never disobeyed your commandments. I am perfect. Yet you never gave me even a goat so that I could celebrate with my friends. I missed out on the partying and the fun that this hoodlum of a brother had. And now you're honoring him. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your assets with the prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him. Then the father said to him, son, you are always with me, and everything that belongs to me is yours. It was appropriate to celebrate and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive. He's lost, and now he's found. And the story ends. Jesus does not finish the story beyond. This is the ending of the story. What happened to that brother? I think he leaves it as an open question for us to answer. Because we're not the prodigal son, we're the older brother. Watching people come to Jesus, watching people come to a faith, and sometimes in our own arrogance and pride saying, why couldn't I live like that? Sometimes we're the older brother. The good news is this. God understands where we are, and he's given us a way to not live in fear, to not worry about what we're missing out. It's a little interesting. This is what I want to share with you this morning. He says, come to me, all who are weary and burdened. I will give you rest. As Jesus says this in the first century, he's talking to Israelites who would have thought back instantly in their brains about what he's calling and talking about. What they had in their hands were the Old Testament, the scrolls in the synagogue of the Old Testament. And so what he's going back to here is a time when God said, I am going to give you everything you need to the people of Israel. And we find this in Exodus chapter 20. If you want to flip over there, Exodus chapter 20, you've probably read that passage several times as well. This is what we call the Ten Commandments. But I want to give you an idea and the setup of what's going on here, and then kind of maybe bring it to light a little bit different than maybe you've heard it before. Because the people of Israel are trapped in Egypt. They're enslaved by the Egyptians. They've been there for 400 years. Right? And Moses is raised up as a prophet to lead them out. And they follow him after these plagues and all these kind of things. They follow him out into the desert. And the people are free of slavery. They're free of the bondage, the things that were trapping them and keeping them. And yet they're not quite complete in their journey. Right? We know the story. They got a long way to go. But out in the desert, there's a promise that God made to Moses, and he said, if you'll trust me, I will meet you in the desert. And so he brings the people out to the mountain of Sinai, and Moses goes up to the mountain, and God delivers him the law, what they call the law, what we call the law. The central part of this is the Ten Commandments. And Moses comes down with these things written on the tablets, and with this simple act of giving a law, he creates a people. Okay? We are nothing. If there is no Constitution of the United States, we're not Americans. Right? We have to have a foundational law that establishes who we are. This is just social, this is government 101 kind of stuff, right? And so God says, I'm going to call you by name. I'm going to lead you out. I'm going to free you from where you are. I'm going to give you a law. I'm going to create in you a nation. You're going to be a people. I'm going to be your king, and I'm going to give you the rules. And so he gives them the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are kind of interesting. Because there's a lot going on there. I just want to kind of give you an idea, a synopsis of something. And I want you to think about this, about how this works. Because while we're not strictly under the Ten Commandments today, we know that Jesus fulfilled the law, right? But they give a construct, they give a framework for us to work in, to think about what God wants from his people. From his people who he would call out of slavery. So the Ten Commandments start with the very first commandment, and it's, you shall have no other gods before me, right? I am the God alone, no other gods before me. And then the second one comes up, and he says, don't make any images of me, right? Don't make anything to represent me. right? Because I am supreme. I'm the number one. I'm the only one. So there's no reason to make an image of me. There's no reason to put me in a temple somewhere, make a statue or something. I am it. And then the third one, he says, don't take my name in vain. My name is holy because I am the one who has saved you. I am the one that's everything to you. First three commandments. Then he hits on the Sabbath. Honor the Sabbath. And then he says, honor your father and mother. Right? And then he jumps into the remaining six commandments down below. And they're things like, do not murder, do not steal, do not covet your neighbor's wife, do not give false testimony to one another. And so when we look at these Ten Commandments, we kind of come up with some similarities here. Now hang with me here for just a second, because I think this is really quite fascinating. The first three commandments are talking about who? God. There shall be no other God before me. Don't take my name in vain. Don't make any images of me. The final six are talking about what or whom? Others, right? Don't kill. Don't commit murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't give false testimony against someone. Don't covet something that... Don't have jealousy with one another. And stuck right in the middle are what we might call number four and five, right? Four and five. I guess the bottom five. So four and five, my numbers are wrong. Sometimes they count them differently in different places. But anyway, four and five, we've got Sabbath and we've got honor father and mother. Okay? What do those have in common? What do those have in common with each other? You got God at the beginning, you've got others at the end. Some of you guys who are taking Bobby's class, you know, the love God, love others, do stuff, Bob Goff stuff. Those are real clear, right? Love God, love others. What's that one in the middle? There's two in the middle. What are they? Honor the Sabbath. Honor your father and mother. There are some rabbis, and quite a few of them actually, who have over the years kind of come up with some ideas about this, and even some biblical scholars. I was talking with a professor of mine at Oklahoma Christian, having a discussion about this not too long ago. And what's really interesting is most rabbis for years and years and years have seen the commonality between these two in time. Honor the Sabbath. Keep it holy. What was the Sabbath? Now, to me, growing up as a kid, you know, we talk about you can't do certain things on Sunday. Remember the blue laws we used to have? You couldn't go shopping on Sunday because it's Sunday, right? That's the Christian Sabbath. That's not necessarily true, but that's, you know, you can't do that. That's God's day, and so you can't do that. Whoops. I just turn something off. Did I mess that up? Okay, sorry. You can't do it because that's God's day. But here's the interesting thing about those two commandments. Those two commandments are the only two positive commandments in the lists. Everything else is do not, right? You shall not have. You shall not do this. Do not do this. Do not commit. Do not. But those are honor the Sabbath. Keep it holy. Honor your mother and father. The positive comments. In the wilderness, as the Israelites are standing there in the middle of the desert at the foot of Sinai, God says, I am going to give you a people who have been enslaved for 400 years. I'm going to give you a day off. You don't have to work. This was not normal in ancient Middle Eastern cultures. You worked all the time. And slaves especially, 24/7. Can you imagine 400 years of working 7 days a week and finally someone saying, hey, by the way, I'm going to give you Saturdays off. What? Are you kidding me? My wife's got a list a mile long of stuff for me to do, right? I'll never get on it. That's awesome. A day off. This was not something that God was prohibiting work on the Sabbath, but rather it was a gift to His people. You don't have to work. Why? Because I am holy. I worked for 6 days creating the world, and the seventh day I rested, and I want you to rest too. There is a rhythm of life that I want you to look at and take part of. Does it make sense? Go back this one right here. The rhythm of life. 6 days of work, 1 day of rest. 6 days of work,
one day of rest. 6 days of work, one day of rest. And not just laying around watching Netflix, but rather resting in God. Jesus says, come to me and I will give you rest. 6 days of work, day of rest in God. 6 days of work, a day of rest in God. And what do? 6 days of work. Well, we do 5 days of work and then we do all of our stuff on the weekends and then we spend an hour or so right here checking off that box with God. And then back to it because we got stuff to do this afternoon, right? We got to get out of here. We got to get to lunch. We got things I got to do this afternoon. That's not the rhythm God asked us to be a part of. He wanted us in His life. He wanted Him in our lives on a regular basis. Keep it holy. Over and over and over. Okay, so that's the Sabbath. What about this honor your father and mother? One of the greatest things you could do is honor your father and mother in the Jewish culture. Honor, it's the one that comes with a promise and you'll have a long life. You'll live long. Just like the thing, don't eat the tree because you'll die. If you honor your parents, I'm telling you, you're going to live a long time. You're going to have a good life. Why? What was the parents' first rule? What was the thing that the parents were laying down more than anything? Deuteronomy 6. Share this with your family. Teach my precepts, my laws to your kids. Do it while you're walking. Do it while you're eating. Do it while you're sleeping in the morning and the evening. Do these things. Teach these things to my... Teach me to your children. God says, honor your parents. Pick up the mantle where they leave it. Like Elijah throwing off his mantle and Elisha picking it up and carrying it. Honor your parents by picking up the faith that they have shared with you and going forward. The Sabbath becomes a personal routine, a rhythm of life for myself. 6 days, one day, work, rest in God, work, rest in God, work, rest in God. I know what's coming around, rest in God. I know what's coming around, rest in God. Always there on a regular basis. And then he says, and now I want you to do it generationally. Not just for you personally, but do it from generation to generation to generation. Honor your parents. It's a time thing. Now, what's interesting about this is Jesus talks about this in this verse right here, Matthew chapter 22. One of the experts in the religious law asked him a question to test him and said, "Teacher, which commandment is the greatest?" And Jesus said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment." And then he says, "Love your neighbor." The second is like this. "Love your neighbor as yourself. All of the law and the prophets depend on these two commandments." So we've got two separate commandments, right? We've got love God, which in a sense he's summarizing the first three verses, the first three commandments of the Ten Commandments. And then he says, love others, neighbor as yourself, which he's kind of summarizing 5 through 10, right? What does he not hit? Right in the middle, right? Why not? Why didn't he say, oh, and by the way, you need to keep the Sabbath and honor your father and mother? I'm going to suggest to you it's because this was so ingrained in Jewish culture. The Jews understood the first three commandments and the last five were held together by those two. How did I love God and love others? I lived the rhythm of life. Work and rest. Work and rest and honor. Work and rest and honor. And that's the only way that those two sections of the law held together. Am I saying we take a Sabbath? No. Hear me out. What I am saying is living a life that is in rhythm with God. Seeing that He is there on a regular basis. And I'm not talking about showing up for Sunday morning church. This is a great place to start. But this is just kind of an encouragement. We don't usually lament here. When's the last time you came to church and lamented? Carol Sori is grieving this morning. Are we grieving with her?
We come to church because we want to be encouraged and inspired a lot of times. It's our little acetaminophen or our Advil to peck a purpose, bap us back up, whatever the word is. Give us a caffeine shot and send us that back on the world. It's not. Together, living life the way God wants us to is grieving and lamenting and praising and encouraging and doing all those things together on a regular basis. It's not always just on Sunday. That's what He's calling us to. When Jesus says this, He talks about these two commandments. They're like two pillars, right, that are holding things up. He says here at the bottom, all the law and the prophets depend on these. Other verses, actually, the Greek word there is hang upon these, right? Hang upon these. Hang on a second. Yeah. So, I have a stake right here. Where's my thing right here? Nope. Right here. Go here. So, a pillar, something strong, something that can hold something. Now, when I think about this, I think of hanging on something. I think of like drilling a nail. In fact, I got one of those two. Hang on a second. Get it right here. Nail right here, right? So, Dickie, look away. So I think about driving a nail into a stake or driving a nail into something and then hanging things on it, right? I hang my hat, hang my coat, hang my clothes, whatever I'm going to do. Hanging, all the law and the prophets hang on these. But this is not a these, this is a this, right? So we're actually talking about two things. So Rafe, Harry, come here. Hurry, come on. Rafe, come on. Rafe, yeah, you too. Harry, hold that right there. I got another one down here. Okay. So, two of these things right here. Rafe, come over here. Hold this up for me. So, these pillars of God's law that's still really valid for us. This is love God and love others. That looks like a G. Love others. Love God and love others. And all the law and the prophets hang upon these. Now, to a Jewish ear, when he's listening to this, they're going to think law and prophets, they're going to think tabernacle. They're going to think temple, right? And they're not going to think hang as in a nail and hanging something. They're going to think like canvas hanging over the structure of these two pillars, God and others. The law and the prophets hang like a place where you come in to meet God. Because that's what they did. They went to the temple to meet and encounter God. They went to the tabernacle to meet God face to face. They went to encounter Him on a regular basis in the rhythm of life. As Christians, we don't see it this way. As Christians, we're going to see it this way. Two pieces, two pillars held together by the rhythm of life, the nail, the rhythm of life, living and resting in Him, honoring generation after generation. And we're going to see these things held together in the form of a cross. On which, Jesus says, all the law and the prophets hung. He was the fulfillment of the law. He was the fulfillment of the prophets. And they hung on the law, on the pillars of loving God, loving others. And how did they do it? Living the rhythm of life. Folks, we have got to be about living the rhythm of God on a daily basis. We've got to be about making our decisions, not based on my wisdom, but based on what God's wisdom is. And you say, how do I know what God wants me to do? We're looking at this piece of property over here. Do we sell the property or do we not sell the property? Who's got an idea? Who's got an opinion? I've got an opinion. I've got an idea. It's not about me. Only when we live our lives in the rhythm of God, spending time with Him, away from everything else, but with Him, and honoring our family, honoring our community of believers together, that's when we start to hear, start to know, and are able to discern what the true will of God is. When we trust, in God, the Creator, I wrote this down because I didn't want to forget this. When we trust in the author of life, is what Paul calls him in Luke calls him in Acts. All things are ours, according to Paul in Corinthians. He has already secured for us, according to Ephesians, every spiritual blessing. And in Jesus' own words in the book of Matthew, saving up for us eternal treasures. That's what we should be about. We're asking you to pray for the next 2 months. To live a rhythm of life where God can be in your life on a regular basis. And we don't want feedback from you about what you think the best idea is. We want to know where God is leading this congregation as a whole. We want to know what we are should be, what we are about and what we should be about. Not because it's my idea or your idea, but because it's God's will for us. And I encourage you to live that way. We've got a song to sing. If there's any way that we can encourage you in that regard, if there's any way that we can help you live those rhythms of life, we want to do that today for you. Let's sing a song.